We're joined by a special guest this week as we discuss the anime, manga, and film series that all started with a single Dragon Ball and one precocious boy with a monkey tail. Do the massive creatures in DBZ count as kaiju, and will we coast on a cloud to its ultimate ending? Join us as we discover all that and more, this time on Kaiju vs. History, the Dragon Ball Special.
Kaiju versus history. This is your super saying nice things about super-sized kaiju, Patrick. And joining me is someone whose wish with the Dragon Balls would be for a Gamera the Brave sequel, Miles. Hello, Miles.
That's exactly what would happen. Actually, no. I'm halfway through wishing for world peace.
And you're like, a full Gamera the Brave sequel series.
No, I'd be like, oh, I want Criterion to do Surf Ninjas on Blu-ray 4K.
Oh, jeez. That's even worse.
The sad thing is, I'm not joking.
Joining us this week for this very special episode are the fine folks from the Final Forum podcast. Jelly and Bikini, welcome you to the show, Kaiju versus History.
Thanks for having us. This is Jelly. Yeah, just so that you know our voices apart. And
this is Bikini, and I second the Surf Ninjas Blu-ray.
we did a whole episode on what would you wish for if you could wish for anything. And much like Miles, we both went very selfish. Neither one of us said world peace.
No.
Bikini said he would wish for any amount of money he needed. He would reach into his pocket and that amount of money would be in there.
Oh, that's nice.
That's a pretty good one. I always, and like, there's no genie rules that say you can't do this. I just want a notebook that whatever I write down in it comes true. So like, ooh. I can basically wish for
a million wishes.
Yeah. Or exactly whatever I want. Loophole. Yes. And I've never seen like the genie's like, no, that doesn't work. It's like, why not? My Dragon Ball wish would be that. If I can only have one wish, give me the magical meta notebook.
Mine was complete and utter mastery over time. So like, you know, you could blow rewind, up, speed down. Yeah. You could take a time out. I was like, I was thinking, honestly, God, there's so many times where I just feel like I need another extra 2 hours of sleep. And I would like my alarm would go off, and instead of hitting the snooze button, I would just hit timeout on time and
oh, like Zach Morris style,
and like finish sleeping.
Nice.
I've been very serious in my quest for a Surf Ninjas blue release. Like, I've talked to Adam Cowan, who played Nicholas Cowan, who played Adam in the movie, the youngest brother. Who does a lot? He's like an LA street artist, and he does some other graphic design stuff, and I think does the Surf and Just store. And he had asked about like, what are some things that you would like? And I was like, hey, any chance on getting a physical release of the movie? He goes, we've been trying for years, dude. He's like, I met Ernie Reyes Jr. Last year. He did a con down in South Carolina, and won. The sweetest dude in the entire world. Like, it's exactly who you want him to be. But he said the same thing. He's like, people have been trying to get this movie released, and I think it's like there's some rights entanglement from that time period that no one's been able to figure out. Which has nothing to do with kaiju, but everything.
Surprisingly, not one kaiju in the Surf Ninjas film. There should be, though. There should.
Yeah, there needs to be like a Tone Loc Leslie Nielsen kaiju movie, I feel like.
Earlier this year, we had a very fun time watching Dragon Ball Z's film Lord Slug with you guys on the Final Forum podcast, which maybe was 4 months ago. I'm not sure when this episode's coming out, but we were excited to have you on here to talk a little bit more about one of the things that Jelly and I originally talked about was just how many and how large are the kaiju in the mostly in the DBZ, the Dragon Ball Z series, with you here on the podcast. And it is not a kaiju show, for those of you who have not seen Dragon Ball Z, but there are so many massive creatures in the universe. And I don't know, that is that just something about the Japanese zeitgeist, especially at the time, the Heisei period in the 80s and 90s, that they are just in love with these giant monsters?
It is, and it's also Toriyama himself. Mm-hmm. He grew up in the 60s and 70s when these movies were massively popular. So he talked about it all the time. He grew up watching Ultraman. He was more of a TV guy. He was the guy mm-hmm. who would go to the movies because it was the way to get out of like the sun in the summer. You know, you spend 50 cents in those days and you go see like three crappy B movies in a theater and just get out of the sun for a while. But he grew up on television and he grew up watching Ultraman, and we talk about it all the time on our show. And like, if you want to follow us over on Blue Sky, to give ourselves a little plug there, I've done like entire threads on like, if you're a Dragon Ball fan, why should you care about Ultraman? Or if like you're an Ultraman fan, what in Dragon Ball would be interesting to you? So like, we've laid out how often Toriyama talks about it in his other work. And so it's a big part of the DNA of Akira Toriyama himself, especially the Showa era entertainment. Dragon Ball has almost a similar way of itself that that Godzilla had, where mm-hmm. Dragon Ball ran for a very long time and then was on hiatus for also a very long time. And also there was an American version that was really heavily hated that made the Japanese kind of come back to it. And so actually when Dragon Ball was coming back as Battle of Gods, which then spawned Dragon Ball Super, a whole new series and everything, Toriyama talked about the original script he got for it. He said it was too serious, and he wanted to take the entertainment itself back to the Showa era. He really liked the more episodic and the more lighthearted storytelling of that era. So it's part of the DNA of Japan for sure. I mean, because you know, Naruto even has giant monsters in it, right? There's the giant toad and things like that. So it is definitely part of just Japanese culture, but Toriyama himself, huge that, Godzilla and Ultraman fan.
That makes a lot of sense, actually, when you put it that way, like in terms of the Showa era, because like a lot of the Showa era films have this sort of fairy tale whimsy about them that Dragon Ball also seems to have. There is a very kind of like, every time I've seen an episode of Dragon Ball or Dragon Ball Z, it does feel like it harkens back to the storytelling of a different time. And mm-hmm. I had never really like thought about that until you started kind of making that association with the Showa era, but that makes perfect sense to me.
Well, the original Dragon Ball was kind of a retelling of Journey to the West.
Yes.
So it was like a fantasy epic, but also a science fiction retelling of this ancient kind of folktale.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, we talk about that all the time. I mean, that's what our show is, right? We go through the here's something that's from later Dragon Ball that's kind of a reference to Journey to the West that you might not mm-hmm. have realized. Like I mean, Vegeta doesn't show up until much later, but we talked a lot about, we did an episode on Vegeta, we talked about how he's very similar to this character called the six-eared macaque in Journey to the West, who is actually a Sun Wukong like double, like he looks just mm-hmm. like Sun Wukong. And the way we kind of likened it to that is like both, you know, Goku and Vegeta are Saiyans, and mm-hmm. so there's that sort of similarity to them. But also the reason that Vegeta finds out about everything is because they wear the scouters on their heads, where he ends up hearing one side of a conversation that's said to someone else over the scouter. The six-eared macaque, because he has six ears, and it's a cultural thing. They say if you're gonna tell a secret, don't tell it. It's a Chinese cultural idiom or proverb. Yeah, that says like, if you're gonna tell a secret, don't tell it in whispering distance or something of the sixth ear, which means if you want a secret, it has to be between you and one other person, not mm-hmm. a third. If you have a third person, it's not a secret anymore, and everyone's gonna eventually know. Someone's gonna tell. And Vegeta overhears this conversation between two people, and he decides, I'm going to go to Earth. And like, that's a catalyst for a whole bunch of things. So Journey to the West, we point out like all the similarities in Dragon Ball. We talk about like the culture and kind of where Dragon Ball is pulling its ideas from. And we definitely, because I'm a Kaiju fan, I've been a Kaiju fan since I was 3 years old. And my dad said, hey, come in here and check this out. This is really cool. And it was Godzilla versus the Sea Monster. That movie will always have a special place in my heart because of that. I've been a Godzilla fan since then. So yes, I try to make sure I include a reference on almost every episode we do. Usually pretty organic though, because Toriyama works so much in, even in things like, just to real quick, like one of the things that's very Showa about Toriyama's storytelling is it has like, he doesn't get into politics a ton. He didn't like politics, but Dragon Ball has one world government. And if you watch a lot of the old Showa Godzilla movies, it's always like a UN coalition or just the government. Like they don't really talk about the different countries of the world in Showa entertainment. It's always just like a coalition.
Yeah. Yeah. And definitely.
That's a very Showa era thing.
Yeah. Well, post it's a very, like, Godzilla. 60s. King Kong versus Godzilla, it became very more kid friendly, of course, but the first two Godzilla movies are pretty darn political in a lot of ways, but it's got to be pretty easy talking about kaiju in Dragon Ball. Even if there isn't a giant monster in the episode, there's just so many cultural bits and bobs that kind of filter through the media. And some of them get super collected in various mangas and anime.
I mean, if you want to talk about right in almost the very first episode of Dragon Ball, you've got a nod to Ultraman. A cornerstone of Dragon Ball is the Hoi Poi capsules, which are these magical capsules that they press a button on them, you throw it, and like anything can come out of it. Ultra 7, Dan Moriboshi used capsule monsters, and they look a lot like the Hoi Poi capsules.
And a lot of people say it's a big inspiration for Pokemon, you know?
Yes.
Is that the third series? No. Ultraman.
Ultra. It's, Eternal, third, Ultraman, it's technically the third series because Ultra there's 7. Ultra Q, Ultraman, Ultra 7.
Yeah. I'm just looking at my shelf and the numbers on the DVD cases.
It's the second series of Ultraman, but it's the third Ultra series.
Right. So one thing in talking about Dragon Ball kind of as kaiju adjacent media was, I guess my understanding of it was you've got Saiyans who have a giant monkey form. Which I had seen growing up, and Piccolo can also just grow supersized whenever he wants, apparently. But there are a lot
whenever he remembers.
There's a lot of enemies over the course of the show that are supersized, and it's always a great. It happens a lot in American comic books as well. You get Superman is so powerful he has to fight a giant robot or a giant alien or an entire fleet of bad guys. And often, and actually one of the first kaiju ever on the big screen here in the US was in a Superman animated film, which we talked about on the podcast, in a creature that looks so much like Godzilla, but it came out like a decade before, Gojira came out. I want to talk about
one of the things we talked about with Ultraman specifically was like there were some parallels between Superman and Ultraman, and even watching this film where like, you know, as a Dragon Ball kind of neophyte, like seeing towards the end of the film where Goku's got to pop up and like, hey, I need the sun, which as an American viewer, I'm like, oh, like Superman, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And is that an intentional thing? Or is there a different reference they're making with something like that?
I think it's one of those things that gets to be almost a circular reference, right? It begins actually as a Journey to the West thing because the Monkey King, who is actually the namesake of Goku. So in Journey to the West, the main character is named Sun Wukong.
Right.
That is the reading of that character's name in Chinese. When you take that character's name and translate it into Japanese, it becomes Son Goku. That is Goku's name. He is named directly after the Monkey King of Journey to the West. That character is based on a Hindi character named Hanuman, who was born from the inside of a peach pit. And so when they end up revealing that Goku came out of this Saiyan space pod, that's supposed to be a reference to Sun Wukong and a reference to Journey to the West and a reference to Hanuman. But It also has filtered so much just into pop culture, because Superman also takes its cues in a weird way. Superman actually is taking its cues from some of this East Asian philosophy as well. And so it becomes this like circular reference, right? Mm-hmm. Where the more they reveal about Superman being similar, or Goku being kind of similar to Superman, it's a bit more of a Hanuman or Sun Wukong reference, but it lines up really well with Superman. It's like almost like a trope of storytelling in general.
Right, right. And that's why I was asking, because I didn't know if that was a direct reference. But as an American viewer, that I've seen that exact scene so many times in Superman cartoons or movies.
It gets exacerbated in translation because a Japanese viewer, an Asian viewer will see a lot of what Goku does and instantly be like, okay, that is just for lack of any better word, that is a bastardized version of Sun Wukong, right? Because he's a character who loves to fight. Goku's a lot more likable than Sun Wukong based on the little bit of Journey to the West that Bikini and I have consumed so far.
True.
We kind of hated that character.
It's a bit of a jerk. That's kind of the point, though.
The story is more about him. It's almost like a redemptive story for him. But like a Japanese viewer will definitely see Sun Wukong. What translation did over the years was take a lot of his dialogue, a lot of Goku's dialogue, where he's like, I want to fight someone strong. And that's all there is to it, to be like, I need to stand up for justice, or I need to help out the weaker people, because this was, I think we've talked about this just casually. This is before companies knew what to do with anime. And they were treating it like an American cartoon. They were trying to hide the fact that this was a Japanese cartoon. They were trying to market Dragon Ball Z as just another cartoon in the block of cartoons that they would air all the time. And so they really strip out all of the like cultural references, and they make they strip out all the things that make him seem like not so much of a hero. Because Goku's not really like a superhero. The way he's written in Japanese, he's really, I've heard people phrase it really eloquently before, where they're like, Superman is a hero. Goku does heroic things, right? Mm-hmm. Like Superman wants to do what's right, and Superman wants to do what's good. Goku just wants to do what's right. It doesn't matter if like that right is maybe not necessarily a good thing.
he kind of sounds more like Ryu from the Street Fighter franchise,
probably,
because his journey of strength is more personal, right?
Yeah, and he's also just looking to fight the best fighters. There's no like in traditional Street Fighter lore, Ryu's not trying to take down Vega or Bison and Shadaloo. He is trying to be the best warrior. And that happens to coincide with doing the right thing as well. So that's what rings like familiar to me.
Yeah. Very infamous, I'll say, speech between Goku and Frieza, which is, I mean, that is sort of the height of Dragon Ball. It's where like a lot of people really got into Dragon Ball, is like when Goku first goes Super Saiyan and fights Frieza. He has a speech that he gives to Frieza in Japanese. Basically, Frieza's like, what are you? Because like he's like a monster to him at this point, because he is a character like Frieza has never faced a challenge before in his entire life. And here's this character now who's literally slapping him around and like almost toying with him. And he's like, what are you? You're like a monster. And Goku's like, I'm your reckoning. I am a Saiyan. I'm your biggest fear. I'm a Saiyan raised on Earth. I was raised to be good, and now I'm strong enough, and I'm going to kill you. And that's all he says in the Japanese, basically.
Mm-hmm.
In the American dub, he says, like, I'm the hope of the universe. I'm a warrior for truth and justice. I am an ally to good, a nightmare to evil. Like, they really play up the superhero of it. So
yeah. Now, is that still present in the dub that's available currently today? Or has that been changed? Or
I don't know if they've changed it for Kai, but in terms of like the Blu-ray release of the unedited, the blue. Getting into Blu-ray and Dragon Ball is a whole other issue.
Yeah.
But in terms of the Blu-ray of the non-Kai version that you can get today, or the Crunchyroll non-Kai version that you would watch, that speech is, I'll say, mistranslated. Stays that way, yeah.
That's unfortunately, because what you paraphrased from it sounded really, really good. And, look, I love American comics, don't get me wrong, but the American version pretty much sounded a lot sillier.
You know, it always makes me interested to be like, how are American comics, are they translated any differently in Japan? Because, you know, DC and Marvel have translations in many other countries. So I'm wondering if there's a similar kind of
that'd be a really
cross-cultural contamination. Yeah.
Is Superman like a little bit more of a jerk in Japan? Well, right?
And what you mentioned does kind of happen a little bit, I think, with Godzilla over many decades, is his character did change with audiences kind of projecting on him becoming the hero of the story. Mm-hmm. Because he really wasn't until like his fifth movie, you know?
You're talking about like out and out hero. Where there's almost not even lip service paid to him being like the villain anymore. It's probably not until like Sea Monster, maybe, right? Which is like the seventh movie. Because
I was about to say you talked about that, but you know, it was originally supposed to be a King Kong film, Godzilla versus Ebra. So he is in the role of what would have been the hero of King Kong, because Japan loved King Kong, which is why we got the 1962 movie. And
Toho tried to do a second King Kong versus Godzilla movie for like 60 years.
Soon to be trilogy.
Yeah. Before they finally kind of roundabout got one with the monster. Yeah. Verse, right. They came pretty close, my understanding. I think they came pretty close in the Heisei era, actually, of there being a King Kong versus Godzilla. Yeah. And then then they were going to do Mechanicong, and then that evolved into Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla 2.
Super fun movie.
I did enjoy King Kong versus Godzilla. King Kong is definitely the hero there. Mothra versus Godzilla. Mothra is the hero in that movie.
Oh yeah.
And
in Ghidra, sure, Ghidra's the villain, but like Godzilla, when he first appears, is a bad guy in that.
It's still a bit of a threat. I would say.
Yeah, because isn't Mothra like asking for help, and Godzilla's like, no.
I mean, he shows up, he nukes a cruise that's filled with innocent people. Mm-hmm. He makes landfall, destroys a bunch of buildings, then he starts fighting Rodan, and they're like, yeah, Godzilla and Rodan are basically like destroying everything in their path as they fight each other. And then Mothra shows up and she's like, guys, stop. And Godzilla's like, how about no? Because they're jerks and I'm not going to help them.
Godzilla feels more like the Vegeta of this universe, and eventually becomes the main character, obviously.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And I think by the time we get to the 70s Godzilla films, he is just straight baby face. He is the hero. And he's also turned into a representation of Japan as a whole. I feel like almost all the large kaiju sized threats we get in Dragon Ball Z feel more Eastern or Chinese in a lot of way, because we get the giant ape forms of a lot of the Saiyan characters, and we don't have to talk about these in order, but I've got stats for Golden Giant Ape, Goku coming in at like 75 feet, and Vegeta a little bit taller at 82 feet, 25 meters. These are massive creatures, you know.
Uh-huh. And those are actually based, it's funny because there's obviously the King Kong element to them. But if you want like a more one-to-one representation of what the Ozaru form is kind of based on, it's actually a character that is giant ape monster Goro from Ultra Q.
Right. Yes.
It looks almost exactly.
Yeah, like
Uzaru form.
Ultra Q.
Ultra Q, very important because obviously it is the precursor for Ultraman. But it also it's just like a wild it's like a Twilight Zone
Japanese
for,
Outer Limits.
Yeah,
I love Outer Limits. The Kaiju X-Files almost. And yes. I really love the 90s Ultra Q the movie. That
movie's great. It's actually an 88 or 89. It's technically an 80s movie. Because me and my buddies talk all the time about how we wish there was more 80s kaiju stuff out there. Because the effects really peaked in the 80s, I think, for kaiju. Aside from Gamera's 90s entries, I think the two Godzilla films of the 80s are the peak of Godzilla.
Oh, Biollante is like one of my favorite Godzilla films of all time.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
It's great. I'm definitely more in the Gamera camp for the Heisei series. But
I know you are. they're good movies. I'm not going to say they're not.
The thing, though, about it is even the early 90s has such an 80s flair in Japan and in Japanese films. They all feel like. And that's just kind of the way style happens across the globe. It feels like the 80s that we think about is like actually 1985 to 1995.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Sure.
The Goldbergs is a good example of that. Like the Goldbergs spans the late 80s, or early 90s, but it all feels kind of 80s. But
you said that specifically for me, didn't you? You know, I want that show.
Other monsters I don't recognize that I've dug up some stats on. Hira Degarn in the series was in Dragon Ball Z Wrath of the Dragon.
That's it's Harutagarn.
Harutagarn.
And that is a character that's created for a movie. And when you guys were on our movie episode, we talked about it. But so just in case your listeners were big jerks and don't go over and listen to our episode.
Don't be jerks.
They would never.
But just in case,
some of our listeners are jerks. I'm talking to you specifically.
You said it, not me. You said it.
Say it again.
but just in case people are only listening to this one, those movies were created to basically advertise the show, essentially, right? So they don't tie into the show at all. And this character Harutagarn is a giant kaiju-sized monster that appears in the movie Wrath of the Dragon. And that's his final design is the one everyone knows. And I don't know if anyone has like his original concept art, but apparently when they showed the concept art to the producer of the movie, whose name was Haruta, he said, "This like sucks. Go back and try again." And they redesigned it, and they created this like really ugly looking monstery thing, and it apparently made his mouth drop open, like it surprised him, like a bung. The onomatopoeia for that facial expression in Japan is gone. Okay. So the monster made Haruta gone. So they call the kaiju Haruta.
Oh, that's cool. I like that.
It's pretty cool design. It's got some alien kind of xenomorph bits to it. It's got kind of, I mean, there's just a lot of Akira Toriyama, alien design all over this thing. But is it? It's kind of demonic as well. It's very cool.
Yeah.
And that
we haven't gotten
huge.
Quite there on our show yet, so I don't know a ton more history than that on it.
I would say that's full kaiju size. It's 48 meters or 160 feet. Godzilla is like, anywhere between 50, 60, and then in the Heisei up to 100 meters. Right. So definitely a massive creature. And then, it's just Goku going up against this giant beast. Not the largest kaiju, because I think more recently in Dragon Ball GT, the Golden Azaru Baby Vegeta form of I thought this was like, oh, well, Vegeta when he was a baby. No, this is like a completely different character that can turn into a nearly 200 foot tall. I guess, is it like a Super Saiyan form of the giant ape?
Yeah, that's probably a pretty good pretty good assumption.
I'm not going to lie. It looks like Whoopi Goldberg's ape character from Tarzan.
that hair. It's like, we got hair, especially hair on a golden
ape. Now that
you
said it, I see it too, for sure.
That's all I see right now.
God, can you imagine if Whoopi voiced the ape in this?
Man, that would be amazing.
Yeah, so this is incredible. This is what the I guess story on this one kind of is so Goku in GT gets turned into a kid, and that ends up making him ultimately kind of regrow his tail, which is a thing that all Saiyans have. He is told via training that, like, if he can harness the power of being a Super Saiyan while having a tail and becoming like a great ape and kind of tap into those two things at the same time, he'll unlock a new power that no one's ever seen before. It's the Super Saiyan 4 is what ultimately it happens. But sort of the transition from Super Saiyan 4 to, or from where Goku is into Super Saiyan 4, is this golden ape, which is like a Super Saiyan great ape. And it makes you way more out of control, way more of a berserker. Goku ends up getting it sort of under control, and that makes him a Super Saiyan 4. Vegeta at this point is inhabited by a character called Baby, who is a Tuffle or a Sufurian. Sufurian is the Japanese word basically for fruit, or I think it's maybe a switching of the syllables that make fruit, and that is because Saiyans are a Saiyan, or a Saiyan in Japanese, is actually a reversal of the syllables for vegetable. Yasai is vegetable in Japanese. That's why Goku is named Kakarot and Vegeta is Vegeta. He's a vegetable. All the Saiyans are named after vegetables because Saiyan is Yasai. It's vegetable. They're, I don't know about arch nemesis or whatever, but like kind of in GT is what they're saying is their arch nemesis are the Sufurians, which are the fruit people. So the vegetables and the fruits are fighting against each other. And this character has inhabited Vegeta's body. And because he inhabits Vegeta's body, he's able to calm the rage of this great ape form, but he can't mix them together in order to harness Super Saiyan 4. So he's only ever able to be this giant ape.
Jelly, Dragon Ball was a very confusing series.
I know. I was following to a point, and I was like, "Wait a minute! Wait, what?"
I trying to do some research for this episode was going through, you know, like wikis and like fan made sites. I'm like, "Wow, this series is a lot more complicated than I ever thought it was."
It's weird because it both is and it isn't, right? It sounds really complicated. There's all this lore, but at the same time, it's all really like, it's almost like it's really dumb lore. And it's designed that way by Akira Toriyama on purpose. He wanted to be able to be understood by 8-year-old kids. So there's a lot that you can understand as an 8-year-old kid, basically.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The vegetable people are fighting the fruit people.
Look, I am a lifelong Power Rangers fan, even before a Super Sentai. I understand dumb lore, so I got
of lore.
All right.
And then the only other creatures in Dragon Ball Z that are much larger than those, and they don't ever really fight, I don't believe. But those are the dragons themselves. The Eternal Dragon Shenron is massive, you know, and can vary in size and scope, I think, in his different appearances, but
there's almost an argument to be made that Shenron, like, we don't see all of his size ever, because he always is like, there's always a piece of him that's inside of the Dragon Balls and coming out of it. We talk about it. I can't remember what movie it is anymore, but we talked about it on one of the movies we were watching, where there's this just shot of Shenron that I really like because it looks like he's still moving, and it just gets this impression that, like, he's the Eternal Dragon, not in only in terms of he's eternally, like, ageless, but he is eternal. Like, he goes on forever,
infinitely long.
And then
the
another
design reminds me to bring it back to Power Rangers, because I mean, it's that Chinese dragon design. In Power Rangers was Serpentera, which was utilizing the dragon character from Die Ranger, which in Die Ranger was a sentient character who was like an avatar of the universe. In Power Rangers, they just used it as Lord Zedd's Zord that always ran out of gas. But it was, for about like 27 years, the largest Zord in Power Rangers lore. I think until like Beast Morphers, but it had that same like that Shenlong design, that big long Chinese dragon, mm-hmm. and even with the kind of it was like the antennae,
the antlers,
the antlers.
Yeah.
I have always liked that design a lot.
Yeah, Chinese dragons look so cool.
The antlers denote. Ooh, I'm trying to remember. Antlers denote either, and I can't remember which one it is. But this is a Chinese dragon thing. Antlers denote either that it is a male or that it can speak. I forget which one of those it is.
Interesting.
And that's like I bet I could look it up real quickly, but it's like the every single aspect of Shenron's design actually like means something in Chinese history. The number of fingers he has is representative of the fact that he is a Chinese dragon versus a Japanese dragon. Mm-hmm. His antlers, I believe, are what denotes that he is a he. I think it's his whiskers then that denote that he can speak. It's like everything about him. Yes, his antlers denote he is a male. Three-finger dragons are associated with the lower class, four fingers with upper class, five-finger dragons are specifically and exclusively only for use by the emperor, and it is a capital offense to draw or depict a five-fingered dragon not for use by the imperials. Japan uses three fingers most commonly in all of their dragons, but Shenron, the main dragon of Dragon Ball Z and Dragon Ball, has four fingers, and that is Toriyama's way of showing that this is not a Japanese dragon, this is a Chinese dragon. He did a lot of stuff with that like there's a lot of stuff that Toriyama did that gets very lost in translation that I don't even know how you would fix in a perfect translation. Because very often Japan uses at least three different methods of writing. There's katakana, there's hiragana, and there's kanji. And they all kind of denote different things. Hiragana, I think, denotes... I can't remember anymore. Kanji's more modern. Katakana's a little more classical. And then hiragana, I think, denotes like more of a connection to China. I might be kind of wrong on that. Yeah, but like... He would use the characters, like he would use hiragana when he wanted to say this is a Chinese character. He would use katakana when he would say this is an old school character. He would use kanji when he would say this is a new school character. Like he played with language so much that I don't even know how you would do it in a good translation. He uses Chinese characters to write the name of Shenron in his Japanese manga to show his readers that this is a Chinese dragon.
Yeah, and it's little cultural things like that we just wouldn't pick up on in our translations of the series. I don't think the translators would really pick up on, but like there was such a huge language shift in Japan after World War II, and there's like a lot of younger people, especially, that are trying to get away from Imperial Japan and took on a lot of the Western world after World War II. And grandparents would have completely different names for household items, for example, than their grandkids. And those are two different worlds, pre-World War II and post-World War II.
Yeah.
To get back to these dragons, I do remember the next largest creature in Dragon Ball Z, Purunga, Shenron, right? It's from the planet Namek.
Yeah. So the lore of Dragon Ball becomes, we got Dragon Balls themselves are in like the very first episode of Dragon Ball. Goku has his
grandfather.
Goku has this four-star Dragon Ball that he says is his grandfather. It's a memento from his grandfather. And that's another like cultural, like shorthand thing, right? They in East Asian culture, they're very spiritual, much more so than we are, and they have spirits and yokai and everything that are like for literally everything, right? If you guys have seen the Great Yokai War, there's like a there's a yokai that counts soybeans all day, and that's like all that he does all the time, and he ends up being the hero of the movie in a weird way. I love that movie, by the way. But so Japan just has this like spirituality associated with everything. And the four-star Dragon Ball, Goku says, is his grandfather. It's a memento from him. But over time, we learn that Dragon Balls were created by the guardian of Earth, the god of Earth, who is a Namekian, who is named Kami, which just means god, actually. Mm-hmm. And we end up learning that all Namekians can create Dragon Balls. And so we eventually go to Namek, which is the homeworld of the Namekians, and we meet their dragon, which is Purunga. And he's just like, yes, a bigger, buffer dragon.
Yeah, kind of has, I would say, Namekian features, alien-esque features to him, but I do enjoy his design. I like this picture that I've picked out in our notes here, because it looks like he's towering over the planet himself.
Yeah.
Over 2,000
fingers.
Is that right? I was trying to count them. Yeah. So he's a good example of
that's like another nod to he is of a higher class almost than the Earth's dragon, right? Mm-hmm. Because he's not sort of like the knockoff version anymore. He is the true, the real dragon, however you want to say it. But yes, he right. is. So he is a class higher, and that's actually brought about in not just his design, but also he can grant 3 wishes, as opposed to the American dragon can only grant 1.
Just straight up genie powers, you know. Oh, yeah. Magical genie powers. Yeah, and then the last thing I found was Super Shenron. Is this an actual thing that exists in
That's from Dragon Ball Super. Which is the it's a little tough. So Dragon Ball is a little tough in terms of like what's canon and what's not canon and what's lore and what's not. Mm-hmm. I always take that when I get asked this question when I go to conferences, people are like, "Oh, what do you consider canon? What's your lore?" Blah blah. I always say, the second you talk about literally anything other than the 500 or whatever it is, so many chapters of Dragon Ball as written by Akira Toriyama.
Mm-hmm.
The second you step outside of that, even into the anime, that's a direct adaptation, you're not canon anymore, because between filler and stuff that contradicts other stuff and movies and all, it all becomes non-canon to me. And so I think, to me, the canon is those 400 or 500 so odd chapters of it, and everything else is not. And I'm good with that, especially as a Godzilla fan. Especially as a Godzilla fan who grew up in the 80s watching the movies crazy out of order, right? I mean, Sea Monster was my first. I think I then saw maybe Ghidra, and then I saw Megalon, and then I saw Raids Again.
Yeah.
And then after Raids Again, I saw Mechagodzilla 74. I actually remember, that movie being directly on the heels of Raids Again, because when Godzilla, which is Mechagodzilla, first shows up and his roar is all jacked up and weird, as a like 5-year-old kid who had just seen Raids Again, which if you've seen the English version of that movie, his roar is tweaked to sound more like Anguirus's roar, because they wanted the movie to be something different. Originally, they wanted to release it as a whole different movie where Godzilla and Anguirus were the same species. They wanted to release it as something called the Volcano Monsters. But so I didn't know that as a 5-year-old kid. I just heard this movie where Godzilla's roar is all jacked up. And then the next time I see him in a new movie, his roar is all jacked up. And I was like, wait a minute, do they change this guy's roar in every movie? I don't think I like these movies anymore. And then the real Godzilla shows up. But
1974's Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla is one of our 10 out of 10 kaiju films. There's a lot to love about it. There's so many weird characters in it.
As a kaiju fan, I like do not get hung up on canon. But
no,
if we want to talk about like, Super Shenron is canon because he's in the manga. And it's not Toriyama's manga at that point, though. It is Toyotaro's manga.
But I only know a little bit, but wasn't Toriyama involved with Super, the manga?
We need to do a lot more research on our end to be able to really speak to it super confidently, because we're not quite there yet in our show. But Toriyama basically really stepped away from Dragon Ball after Z ended,
right?
And he did almost nothing with GT, and it seems like he never talked about it. That's the thing. People are always like, well, Toriyama hated GT, and it's clear because he didn't work on it and stuff like that. It's like he never talked about it. No one ever really asked him about it. And I would say if you look at his reaction to it versus his reaction to other stuff that happened later on, he probably was okay with it. And I think Toriyama steps away from Dragon Ball in at the end of the initial run of his manga and at the end of the anime, and he's like, that's it, I'm done, I'm retired. And he did like various one-shot mangas and other things to like still stay a little busy, but he's retired.
Right.
GT runs and runs for a couple years, and he's like, yeah, it's fine, whatever, I don't care. And he just walks away and he's gone for a very long time. Then they do the American movie, and he said, I would like to be involved in this a little bit. And they said, don't worry, we'll take care of it. And he was like, okay. And he kind of steps back and is like, all right, I'm not going to be hands-on, because I wasn't hands-on in GT. And that turned out, I would think, by his point of view, fine. It does not turn out fine.
yeah, that's an understatement. I mean, it's very much like Toho being like, okay, you can have Godzilla, Hollywood, if you follow these few rules. And they're like, well, we're just going to give you a lot of money.
We're going to hire Roland Emmerich, who actively dislikes Godzilla, to make a Godzilla film for us, because why not?
It should be noted, though, that Toho signed off on everything that they did.
Oh, I know. They tried to pretend they weren't involved, but they did. They signed off on everything.
but Toriyama just is like, okay, I'll let that just run, because GT ran and it didn't do anything bad. It obviously, Dragon Ball Evolution does not go well. So Toriyama says, I think it's never really stated, but I think at that point, Toriyama says to himself, there's never going to be another Dragon Ball project that I don't at least have.
Okay.
at least have an overview of. And so Dragon Ball Z Battle of Gods was already being written at this point. He steps in and says, I want to see the script. They send him the script, and it's a very different movie to the one we end up getting. It's much more serious. The God of Destruction, Beerus, who's a character who's like, he's a silly little cat who is the most powerful being in the universe, who could destroy the entire universe with like a flick of his fingers. That's a cat, though. He's a cat. He sometimes is like, okay, I'll be fine and I'll play and hang out with you. And sometimes he's like, and I don't like your food, so I'm going to destroy your whole planet. He is a cat. He's a silly little cat.
Love it.
That's Toriyama coming in and being like, no, we're not going to make like a super serious movie. It's going to be silly and full of gags, because that's what my story is.
Mm-hmm.
And so Toriyama was involved in Super, but what would happen basically is they had what they called a Dragon Ball writer's room. And it was Toriyama, Toyotaru, who actually wrote, inked, and drew the Super manga, and a few producers, and a guy by the name of why can't I think of his name? Bikini, what's his name? What's the guy's name that I don't like?
Oh, don't put me on the spot like this. Come on.
Akio Ioku. Akio Ioku was like the head of the writer's room. And they would get together and be like about four people in a room. And the producer guy, like the guy from Shueisha or Toei, would be like, here's what we want to do next. Like, here's the next story that we want to do. And Toriyama would basically be like, I would never do that, but if you made me do that, here's how I would do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of how Super would end up being written very often, is the pitch of the basic idea was something that Toriyama would be like, I wouldn't have done that. But if you were going to make me do that, here's how I would do it.
Okay. So in the manga, even though it's credited to Toriyama, he wasn't the actual like writer for those stories.
He just was like, early on, I think it was much more hand in hand with him and Toyotaru, who was like the successor to Toriyama. But by the time Goku Black, which is like the third arc of Super, rolls around, it's basically Toyotaru writing the monthly chapters and then sending them over to Toriyama, and Toriyama being like, change this one line, change that character's design. I don't like the way you drew this one panel. Change it to this. It's got better composition that way, and you're good.
Gotcha.
Which is actually, it's kind of a funny, really interesting thing that the last panel of the manga that exists right now, the official manga, Toriyama actually had a note on it to Toyotaru. It's the end of the superhero story, but it basically has Piccolo picking up Pan, who's Gohan's daughter, from school. And he picks her up and flies away with her. And Toriyama wrote a note to Toyotaro at the end that said, have Piccolo on his way back turn and wave goodbye to the teacher, because it's nice to pay respects to a sensei like that. Wow. And then Toriyama passed away like weeks after that.
Oh,
So Toyotaro was like, the last thing that Toriyama ever said to me was like, it's nice to say goodbye to your teacher.
That's crazy.
Wow. And
boy, howdy, talking about him makes me want to read so much more of his works. I mean, not just Dragon Ball, but
if you want other works last, that he's done, we have a couple years, episodes on those.
They've been reprinting things like his the collections of early
Akira Toriyama's Manga Theater.
Yeah,
it's a thick binding, and it like if it's still out there, I don't know if it is. It's been going like in and out of print. But if it's still in print, I would 100% recommend, if you're interested in Toriyama, to grab it. It is $20. It is thick. The first third of it probably actually is not so good because it's his earliest stuff. But the back two thirds of it is like chock full of incredible little one shots and little two chapter manga. There's one really cool one that's like, beginning, how long is it's like 5 pages long, the one that's like the hide and seek thing.
Oh yeah.
It's like this really short one about this, like, I mean, I spoiled it basically, but like it's a really cool, it's like a girl running away and you think it's this super serious thing, and then it just turns out that it's a game of hide and seek. Mm-hmm. But it's really cool. So I would, Akira Toriyama's Manga Theater, it's like, it was $20.
And yeah, still is on Amazon.
It's a massive collection of one shots and two chapter manga and things from him that encompasses like pretty much everything that he ever published during and before Dragon Ball. That's not also Dragon Ball.
Sandland. If you're into, especially early Dragon Ball, Sandland has early Dragon Ball in its DNA all the way through it.
It's got turned into a game recently
and a Hulu series.
Oh, nice. I don't think I knew it was a series.
We watched it. We're running out of Dragon Ball Z kaiju and large creatures, and running out of time here. I wanted to wrap it up, and there is so much more we can talk about in the Toriyama expanded universe.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I wanted to have you guys on to talk about that a little bit, and there are several other, you know, Japanese associated universes that have large creatures and things like that that we could dive into, but Dragon Ball is definitely special.
And that's I don't know when this episode's exactly coming out, mm-hmm. but I did submit a panel for G-Fest this year.
Fun.
So we'll see if this episode comes out before. Fingers crossed. I haven't gotten whether or not I'm doing the panel yet, but mm-hmm. the panel is going to be like a Toriyama Godzilla kaiju references panel. Mm-hmm. It'll be, you know, almost like a spinoff of this episode, right? Where I'll be talking about like kaiju references in and throughout Dragon Ball and Toriyama's works.
Cool. Back and forth between the two universes. That'll do it for this week's episode. Before we go, where can folks find Final Forum? Is there any other things that you want to plug besides perhaps G-Fest in 1 month's time when this comes out, or sometime around then?
So you could find us on all of the socials. We are most active on Blue Sky, which, if you haven't heard of Blue Sky, is basically like Twitter without the Nazis.
That's pretty much.
Ooh, what a hard sell, but sounds good. No, we have our own Blue Sky account.
But we're most active on Blue Sky because that's where I tend to get the most. Like, I'll post the exact same thing on Blue Sky, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube, and I'll get like 5 comments, 10 comments on Blue Sky, and like ghosts on Twitter. Mm-hmm. So
a lot of bots.
We're on all of the socials. So if you want to find us, you could find Final Forum, like a internet forum or a discussion forum. The pun there being that Dragon Ball characters talk about their final form all the time.
Final Forum. Okay, that'll make sense.
So yes, you can find us on all the socials. We're on Discord as well. We've got like just a few people in there right now, but we're constantly trying to grow it a little bit. And we're just, you know, a little more casual, just kind of, hey, here's what I'm doing today. Like I posted a picture of me decorating my 12-foot skeleton on our Discord. I would never put that on our Blue Sky. That's more of a, on Blue Sky. I try to do like a post every single day. Like I do like a manga Monday. I do like a sneak peek or an episode or something on Tuesdays. Wednesday is like Wednesday wares, where I'll talk about like a weird piece of Dragon Ball merch. Thursdays is Thursday threads. Fridays are Friday funnies, which are usually like memes and dumb stuff. Sunday is either sneak peek Sunday or self promotion Sunday. So we'll do like a plug for ourselves or like a sneak peek of an upcoming episode. So yeah, follow us on all the socials. In terms of when this episode comes out, over the summer ish, we will probably be in the middle of the Frieza arc and the Super Saiyan stuff. Ooh. So we'll be talking about why Super Saiyan is gold and the significance of that goes along with like Buddhism and Eastern culture. And very shortly, I think then we'll also be getting into one of my favorite and the most infamous bits of filler in Dragon Ball, which is the driving episode.
Yes.
We have something so fun planned for the driving episode. It's if it works out, it's going to be one of our most fun episodes ever.
I think actually this episode might come out right around G-Fest.
And hopefully be on the lookout for our G-Fest.
So panel. July, hopefully. Yeah. Well, I hope that comes to fruition. Anything else?
If you follow us on those and you get into like our Discord, especially, you'll end up like, I have a Letterboxd as well that I'm on. I post, I try to do a decent review of everything that I watch. I think I'm Jelly Donut 25 on Letterboxd. Yes. I'm Jelly Donut 25 on Letterboxd. I'm a movies guy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we do our little casual catch-up episodes and I'll be like, oh, what are you up to, Bikini? And he's like watching his third new anime series or something.
Yep.
And I'm like, oh, I don't watch anime even though I have a podcast covering it. I'm like, I've watched these 85 movies in the last 3 months.
Bye. My letterbox says that I've watched way too many films.
Yes.
We have our own for the podcast.
What was that screen name again?
It's Jelly Donut 25, GALLYDONUT 25. That is a blast from my past. Yeah, I've watched, oh goodness, too many movies. My letterbox.
Yeah, I by the time I joined Letterboxd, I stopped like trying to like rate movies that I had like everyone I had seen prior.
Yeah.
And so now I just log them as I come to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it became so unwieldy.
In 2024, I made a concerted effort to log everything that I watched, including rewatches, and it was 325. And then in 2025, I didn't do that as much and it was 222. So
oh, nice.
I watch like about 200 new to me movies a year.
Mm-hmm.
I try to get around that.
I was gonna say, Miles watches a lot of film.
I don't always log everything. I'm trying to be better about that. It seems
I'm like trying to be better about not necessarily writing a long review for everything.
Oh no, like, half the time if I do a review, I'm just like, hey, I liked it. This is kind of why every now and then I'll feel like called to like write a proper review. But sometimes I just think of like a dumb pun and I'm like, that's a but I do. It looks like we had similar feelings about Save the Green Planet compared to Begonia.
I liked both, though.
I liked both. I prefer the original.
Me too. It's got that.
Although I will say Emma Stone, amazing performance, deserves all the accolades she's got.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, but let's not talk about every film.
No. We're changing Jelly the show now.
Thank you guys so much for being here.
Of course, thanks for having us.
We'll have to get back together sometime soon. We'll have to figure out a reason to come back. But thank you for being on the podcast and all of our listeners out there. Thank you as well.
We'll have to see. We could maybe get you on when we hit that Hurudagarn movie. We'll figure something out, right?
I mean, I would love to. Yeah, it was a lot of fun earlier in the year talking about Lord Slug, and I just love saying it, Lord Slug.
Yeah, right. Thanks so much for having us on. I know I ramble a lot. I'm good at talking.
Yeah, like I said, We need a longer movie next time, because Lord Slug went by very quickly. But yeah, listen to that episode back in their catalog with us. And yeah, we'll have you guys on again sometime soon, maybe after G-Fest.
Sounds good.
Thank you for being here, and we will catch you next time.
Thanks for having us.